Welcome to tape number 12 of The Ordinance of Covenanting by John Cunningham. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. There is no copyright on this material, and we encourage you to reproduce it and pass it on to your friends. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, CDs, and much more at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalog. If you do have a web connection and would like to be added to our email list, please send an email to add@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. And now to our reading of The Ordinance of Covenanting by John Cunningham, which we pray you find to be a great blessing and which we hope draws you near to the Lord Jesus Christ. Continuing our reading of Chapter 7, Covenanting Adapted to the Moral Constitution of Man, Head number 2, Covenanting Adapted to the Moral Constitution of a Man in a Statement of Grace. In a state of grace, excuse me. First, the reality of the covenant of works appears. It was not unworthy of God to enter into covenant with man in innocence. He was the workmanship of his own hands. The Constitution given to him admitted of intercourse on his part with his Creator. It was not unbecoming the dignity of God's character to give to man a law. It was becoming his character to give him a moral constitution that would lead him to obey it. It was equally unbecoming the glory of his nature to accept of obedience to it. His entering into covenant with him was the accepting of covenanting, a part of that obedience, and was therefore in perfect consistency with the excellency of his being. It is not allowable to suppose that in order to a covenant relation between God and his creatures, these should be able to give something of their own which might be esteemed as a meritorious condition of a covenant. Nor is it warrantable to maintain that because man in innocence was unable to make such a communication, therefore he was not in that state taken into covenant. Neither man in innocence nor man in a state of grace was required to make such a tender. Nay, no creature is able to afford it. If it is admitted, then, that a covenant exists between man and God redeemed on the footing of the merits of the Savior, how can it be denied that man in innocence could be taken into covenant with God on account of the merit or worth of himself as the Creator and righteous moral governor of all? In the case of the covenant of grace, the merit on account of which man is accepted was displayed in a manifestation of the mercy of God in the obedience and sufferings of Christ. In the case of what is rightly held to have been a covenant between God and Adam as the representative of the human family, the merit for which man was accepted was not his own, but the merit or worth of the divine character exhibited in giving him a constitution fitting him for acquiescing in what the divine law required and in affording him every facility for glorifying God by yielding obedience to all his commandments. And besides, various are the considerations that tend to show that from the constitution of man there is reason to conclude that the representative character and state that are attributed to Adam as a covenant head, and therefore also what is called the covenant of works, though in a certain sense a covenant of grace, but not of grace through a mediator, are not inconsistent with the glory of the divine character. It would not have been inconsistent with the glory of God to have made any one of the human family its representative head. No one of them would have refused to represent their race. And since, therefore, Adam would not have refused, it is not warrantable on the assumption that he would have refused to deny that he was commanded to undertake the duties of a federal head. The interests of men were better provided for on the principle of representation than they would have been had it been given to every member of the human family individually to undergo a trial on which would have pended their eternal condition, Had the whole family, human family, been together when sin entered into the world, they had all been as liable to seduction by the enemy as the first of men. But the resistance of him by Adam would have been equal to the resistance of the whole human race, had all the human family at once been present in the very circumstances of temptation in which Adam was placed, would they have acted differently from what he did? They could have done so, but what evidence have we that they would have? God did not vouchsafe an extraordinary power in order to keep Adam from falling. Such would have interfered with the state as a free moral representative being. Would he have done so then to the whole human race had they been then present together? But had Adam continued for an appointed period to obey, life to all his posterity would have been the result, and thus benefits through one as a representative would have come to the many with certainty without all having individually. By being put in a state of probation in the midst of temptation to endeavor to secure a title to life for themselves, it is sinful for men to arraign the procedure according to which men come into the world in a state of condemnation or to deny it. The Scriptures reveal it, and it is a necessary effect of the operation of divine justice. Had it not been right, God would not have instituted such a relation between Adam and his descendants as would have admitted of the fact. Nay, had not that arrangement in itself been preferable to every other, divine wisdom would not have made it. It therefore has a reason for it the most satisfactory, however little we may be able to apprehend it. Nothing that we know is inconsistent with that arrangement, but it may be but a small part of its reason that we yet observe. Man was not doomed, but permitted to fall. It was not necessary that he should be prevented from sinning, and his fall was the necessary effect of his transgression. Is it not dreadful to think of man being brought into existence in a state of sin and misery, of a nature being given to him which never had the power to make one endeavor to live forever? It is answered, God did not create men in a state of condemnation, but sin invaded them, and in one all fell. God is righteous, and his justice finds every one of the family of man guilty. The rectitude of God's character did not require that he should create anyone with a title to eternal life, but because of sin it forbade that any of the children of fallen man represented by him should come into existence in a state of acceptance with him. The case of the sinner coming into the world under condemnation is not worse than that of him who, first having had power to stand, was tempted and sinned and fell. No less consistent with the excellence of the character of God and the sovereignty of his procedures is the state of one fallen even at the very origin of his being than that of one who had had an opportunity to avoid falling, but after a short trial really fell. Adam at first had not a right, independently of the sovereign gift of God, to come into existence in a state of acceptance. He had not a right to continue in it when he sinned. And in like manner, no sinner can say that he had a claim upon the Creator to be brought into being free from the curse. The same argument that would suffice to establish that men should not be implicated in the rebellion of Adam would go to prove that he should not have been allowed himself to fall. And hence, the repugnance of men to the doctrine of original sin is unwarranted and affords no proper ground on which to deny the covenant of works. Secondly, the wicked, whether individuals or communities, and these alone, are not in covenant. Man in innocence was never under the law of God merely as a law. The will of God, promulgated as the terms both of a covenant and a law, had the sacredness of a law. Acceded to by man, it had the sanctity of a covenant. The will of God was propounded as a law, to be received both as a law and as a covenant. The acceptance of it engaged man to it as possessed of both characters. Because of God's authority dictating it as a law, his will revealed conferred obligation. Because of God's will and providential arrangements as to the constitution of man, he acquiescing in the requirement of the law came besides under a covenant obligation to fulfill it. At the very origin of his being, he came under both obligations. Under both, he was placed according to the appointment of the Most High and by his authority. At his fall, the whole human family became exposed to the curse at once of a broken law and a violated covenant. Then and thereafter, the law was a broken covenant. It had been propounded as a law and offered as the condition of a covenant. As a law and as a covenant, it had been acquiesced in and thus stood as a covenant, but by reason of apostasy, it passed from the rank of a law and a covenant to that of a mere law. And as a law proceeded to put forth on the unregenerate the claims for punishment of a law that should still continue, but also of a covenant that had been broken, it could never again exist in its original state. To the ungodly still, it is a law demanding obedience to it, and punishment for past transgression of it as a law, and requiring also not obedience to it as a covenant, but punishment for the breach of it as a covenant. What was the covenant of works? What was the covenant of works is not now a covenant to any. To the wicked, it is a law which by reason of their sin tends to their ruin. The work of the law is written upon their hearts of men in sin, but not as if it were now a covenant law. For now the covenant of works, as a covenant, has no demand of obedience to it on men. The tendency that there is in the unrenewed heart to seek life by the works of the law shows not that the law is there written as a covenant, but that there is there an attachment inconsistent with the will of God to the law as a covenant, which, while there is not felt the desire either of good flowing from a covenant relation to God, or of willingness conscientiously to obey his commands, leads vainly to seek merely exemption from punishment or undefined good. Certainly the blinded heathen have not that law which was broken proposed to them as the terms of the covenant, and so neither have others. The will of God revealed to men in a state of sin has the character of a law, but not of a covenant. The law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless and disobedient. 1 Timothy 1:9. The impenitent transgressor continues under the curse of the law. If not subdued by divine grace, he will continue to feel here the effects of the wrath of God revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, and in the future state will experience the effects of the curse in everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power. The law of God addressed to corrupt ecclesiastical societies is not a covenant, but essentially a law. A national compact between rulers and people, when violated, affords an analogy here. The laws are institutions or ordinances of a nation according to which the sovereign reigns, the other rulers govern, and the people voluntarily give obedience is a covenant. But against those who violate them, whatever may be their rank, they act not as a covenant, but as a law, punishing for breach of covenant. But to proceed, when Israel were holiness to the Lord, his law was to them a covenant. When any of them fell off into idolatry, that covenant was dispensed to those solely as a law, taking vengeance for the breach of it as a covenant and as a law. To the true Israel receiving spiritual blessings, it was dispensed as a covenant, but only as a law demanding punishment and obedience it extended to many in the mountains of the east and on the plains of Babylon, and afterwards in every part of the world to the descendants of the unbelieving Jews. When the Christian church was pure, the law of God was to her a covenant. When, by the removal of the truth and opposition to it, she degenerated into Antichrist, it continued not a covenant to her, but acted against her as a law. And before its blighting curse, she fell plagued. The judgments poured out on the seed of the beast were its effects, and to that curse will be due the accomplishment of the prediction, I will stretch out mine hand upon thee, and roll thee down from the rocks, and will make thee a burnt mountain. And they shall not take of thee a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but thou shalt be desolate forever, saith the Lord. Jeremiah 51:25-26. And the realization of the fearful doom proclaimed by an angel come down from heaven Babylon the great is fallen, and of the woe uttered by a mighty angel that took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall the great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. Revelation 18, verse 21. Even the offers of mercy to the unrenewed are made as the requirements of a mere law. So long as they are unaccepted, they possess the same character. They are tenders of what, when acceded to, would be a covenant, but are not the requirements of a covenant till they be appropriated. When received, they are the duties of both a law and a covenant. For example, the injunction to believe on Jesus, addressed to one in a state of sin, is the command of a law, but not of a covenant to that individual. If not accepted, it binds to punishment for disregard of it as a law, and the non-acceptance of it as a proposed covenant command. If perfidiously received, it binds to punishment for not obeying it, and for deceitfully professing by vow or oath to receive it. Accepted in sincerity and truth, and consequently not by the wicked, but by one born again, it is laid hold on at once as a law and a covenant command, as a requirement of the immutable law of God, and as a duty of the everlasting covenant. Commands addressed to believers are at once, even while inculcated, a law and a covenant requirement. They have acceded to these. Thereafter, such therefore remain not merely a law, but a covenant duty, and as enforcing covenant obligation, fall to be habitually observed. Thirdly, those who are in covenant with God will, as individuals and communities, in some measure make and keep covenant engagements with Him. Every believer, that is, everyone in covenant with God, will after some manner practice such duties. Covenanting is an exercise of the renewed nature and is an essential manifestation of it. From gravitation come the movement of the moon and in her orbit, that of the planets round the sun, and perhaps a progress of the whole solar system through space. From the living energy of the plant cherished by the moisture and heat of heaven proceed the expanding of the leaf and the putting forth of the flower and fruit. From the laws of molecular attraction come the beautiful forms of the mineral, vegetation, and animal creation. From the principle of love to God comes the habit of delighting in Him. From hope come the stimulating anticipations of eternal good. From faith comes the exercise of believing. From the heart, whose energy is delivered from the dominion of sin by grace, are, from their native constitution and by the claims of the God of salvation, engaged to Him in covenant, proceeds the habitual exercise of covenanting. Where there is motion, there and there only force prevails. Where organic efforts is made, there only life exists. Where covenanting is engaged in, there only a covenant relation and title can be found. Every incorporate community that forms a part of the true church of the living God, with greater or less frequency or more or less explicitly, recognizes its covenant obligations by acknowledging and endeavoring to keep them. Where no attention is paid to covenant obligations, there is no covenant relation. The body that does not attract iron or possess polarity is not magnetic. That which does not transmit light or sound is not elastic. That which does not distribute heat is without life. If a society bind not others to itself by religious covenanting after some manner, it belongs not to the Church of God. From the law of covenanting comes all the consistency of the union of believers, the family that is named in heaven. That family, by displaying God's covenant, invites to its communion many who would have perished. The invisible church cannot have associated to it anything dissimilar to itself, but it binds to it those who are congenial to it. It is to the fellowship of the church visible that the members of the church of the firstborn are drawn. God prepares men for the communion of saints. It is by the power of the Spirit accompanying the means of grace dispensed in the assemblies of the faithful that a transforming effect is produced on the natural man and that he is drawn. It is the power and glory of God that draws and unites, and the whole body, like the virgin gold, or silver in the veins of the rock, which is composed of what were grains scattered through contiguous strata, contiguous strata, and by a galvanic power continues to accumulate, has its affinities for each of the precious family of grace. The law by which these are drawn is not merely moral, but gracious. The communion of saints was confederated that, by attracting others to it, it might grow. As a covenant society, and in the use of covenanting, it attracts. It has a tendency to give utterance to its intention, and that by professing the truth, that sinners may be one. As it is written, I believed, and therefore have I spoken. We also believe, and therefore speak. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 13. Then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. Psalm 51, verse 13. By taking the covenant of God publicly in their mouth, his people in measure fulfill the Redeemer's mandate. Have salt in yourselves, and have peace one with another. Mark 9, verse 50. And the corresponding duty, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt. Colossians 4, verse 6. It is a serious mark of a church's imperfection for it to recognize only implicitly or virtually its covenant obligation. The greater the living energy that inhabits the society, the more regard its obligations receive. Finally, how dreadful is the condition of those who are not in covenant with God. It is degraded. Man was in covenant with God at first. With all accepted moral beings, and these alone, he deals by way of covenant. Thus, after some manner, he dealt with angels in glory. Thus he dealt with man unfallen. Thus he deals with sinners redeemed. For sustaining the dignity of a covenant relation to him, inanimate and unintelligent creation are not adapted. But for not standing in that, they are not dishonored. Angels in light, acquiescing in God's law, were at least virtually in covenant with him. Some of them proudly sinned and fell from their high confederation. They took counsel together thereafter, but it was against the Lord. In hell they appear his foes combined in everlasting league against him, but delivered over forever to the terrors of his wrath. To their case alone, that of the wicked ever, even on earth, can be compared. But the case of rebellious sinners here is, if possible, more revolting. Sinners under condemnation receive outward good here, designed to lead them to repentance. All the good diffused around comes through the arrangements of a gracious covenant. They receive temporal good themselves indirectly from a covenant on which they will not take hold. They despise the word of him who ordained that good, the most extensive, should come to sinners through that covenant. Their degradation is extreme. Attempting to go on in opposition to all the arrangements of the Most High, and yet kept in the enjoyment of some good and in the prospect of the greatest, they are an anomaly in the universe. They confederate with one another, but against God. They will not take him into their counsels. They are, therefore, destitute of his favor and of all the honor of cooperating with him. The change to which, by sin, they subjected themselves is more humbling than that produced on any other class of creatures, even on fallen angels themselves, for these resist not offers of mercy. The inanimate creation responds to God's command. He enjoins and it obeys. There the divine mandate has the sure counterpart of obedience. In the world of unfallen intelligences, the word of the Lord is fulfilled willingly by all. In the world of perdition, however, it is set at naught. But on earth, where benefits are dispensed, it is spurned by the wicked also. The twofold curse of a broken law and covenant pursues sinners, yet they are invited to escape it. But they will not submit. A covenant of life and peace is made known. Its blessings, great and precious, are freely offered to them. Yet they cherish the enmity in their hearts, of their hearts, against God, and they will not yield. With no sinless creature of God have they communion. They are voluntarily alone in the universe, at war with all God's creatures, and lowest among them. They are most unworthy. Every arrangement of his providence tends to restore them to his favor. Neglecting the duty of covenanting, they set all these at naught. The beasts that perish are not degraded, but these are. They are worthy to be ranked with apostate angels. In the rage of their rebellion, they are bent on enduring all the terrors of a broken law and covenant in the place of final woe. Let not sinners persevere in their obstinacy. Even yet, there is good largely offered to them, which, if they accept it, they will abundantly receive. Chapter 8. Covenanting According to the Purposes of God. Since every revealed purpose of God implying that obedience to His law will be given is a demand of that obedience, the announcement of His covenant, as in His sovereignty decreed, claims not less effectively than an explicit law the fulfillment of its duties, a representation of a system of things predetermined in order that the obligations of the covenant might be discharged, various exhibitions of the covenant as ordained, and a description of the children of the covenant as predestinated to peculiar privileges and services, make that announcement, and consequently, preferring that the claim of submission to covenant requirements, urge, not less than the others of these requisitions, a dutiful regard to the exercise of solemn covenanting. Many things in creation and in providence were appointed for this, as well as for other ends, that men might make and fulfill solemn vows to God. The works of creation itself decided to lead men to acts of religious homage. The Lord is a great God, and a great King above all gods. In His hand are the deep places of the earth. The strength of the hills is His also. The sea is His, and He made it, and His hands formed the dry land. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. Psalm 95, verses 3-7. The work of creation was performed, that on earth a people might be sustained to serve the Lord. They shall be ashamed and also confounded, all of them. They shall go to confusion together that are the makers of idols. But Israel shall be saved in the Lord with an everlasting salvation. You shall not be ashamed nor confounded, world without end. For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God Himself that formed the earth and made it. He hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Isaiah 45, verses 16-18. In anticipation of bestowing good on His people, even during their continuance on earth, the surety of sinners, when in the creation of all things was decreed, rejoiced. The Lord possessed me in the beginning of His way, before His works of old. I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning, wherever the earth was. When He prepared the heavens, I was there. When He set a compass upon the face of the depth, when He established the clouds above, when He strengthened the foundations of the deep, when He gave to the sea His decree that the waters should not pass His commandment, when He appointed the foundations of the earth, then I was by Him as one brought up with Him, and I was daily His delight, rejoicing always before Him, rejoicing in the habitable part of His earth, and my delights were with the sons of men. Proverbs 8, 22, 23, and 27-31. Hence, of them as the heirs of a comprehensive covenant blessing, it is said in language and substance not unfrequently occurring, the meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. Psalm 37, verse 11. God's covenant with every living creature revealed to Noah was an appointment to confer the means of life on men in order to the attainment of the end of their creation. Other arrangements conducive to the same object are thus described. He shall deliver thee in 6 troubles, yea, in 7 there shall be no evil touch thee. In famine he shall redeem thee from death, and in war from the power of the sword. Thou shalt be hid from the scourge of the tongue, neither shalt thou be afraid of destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine thou shalt laugh, neither shalt thou be afraid of the beasts of the earth. For thou shalt be in league with the stones of the field, and the beast of the field shall be at peace with thee, and thou shalt know that thy tabernacle shall be in peace. Job 5, verses 19-24. This ends side one. Please turn the tape over and continue listening on side two. That the land of Canaan was granted to the Israelites not merely by promise, but by sovereign decree, is implied in the words, "Neither will I any more remove the foot of Israel from out of the land which I have appointed for your fathers, so that they will take heed to do all that I have commanded them." 2 Chronicles 33, verse 8. Israel, fallen from the service of the Lord, is thus addressed, "And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, my husband, and shall call me no more Bali. For I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name." Protection, as ordained in connection with their promise taken into covenant with God, is thus promised, "And in that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, and with the fowls of heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground, and I will break the bow, or the bow, and the sword, and the battle, out of the earth, and it will make them to lie down safely, and I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness, and in judgment, and in loving kindness, and in mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord." Support, too, as in like manner provided for them, crying unto the Lord for the supply of their wants, is promised. "And it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith the Lord, I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth, and the earth shall hear the corn, and the wine, and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel." And not merely reclaimed Israel, but the Gentiles, as by sovereign ordination, interested in all their outward and spiritual blessings, are objects of the promise. "And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, Thou art my people, and they shall say, Thou art my God." Hosea 2, verses 16 to 23. Secondly, the covenant of God as ordained by him manifests that the exercise of vowing unto him was also ordained. That was appointed. In statements regarding the sovereign arrangements of providence is this taught. These were brought into view and their continuance promised in the covenant made with Noah. In that covenant it was secured that the waters of another flood should not overflow the earth. In that too it was promised that summer and winter, seed time and harvest should not cease. The covenant, therefore, as well as these ordinances, its results, was ordained. And accordingly was ordained all connected with its dispensations, from the use of a term employed in prophecy in reference to the waters of the sea. This moreover appears, "Fear ye not me, saith the Lord? Will you not tremble at my presence, which have placed the sand for the bound of the sea by a perpetual decree that it cannot pass it?" Jeremiah 5, verse 22. The term here rendered "placed" in this passage means appointed, and in the two following passages is applied to the covenant. The statement, "He appointed a law in Israel," Psalm 78, verse 5, hence declares the institution of his law as a decree, and the demands of the covenant being those of the law, even as his law. The covenant, it intimates, as ordained, not merely by his high authority, but according to his sovereign will. And thus, too, are expounded David's last words, "He hath made with me," or rather appointed for me, "an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things, and sure," 2 Samuel 23, verse 5, as intimating not merely his cleaving to God's covenant, but his recognition of that covenant as according to the good pleasure, to his good pleasure, in all things decreed. That covenant was established. God said unto Noah, "That is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth." Genesis 9, verse 17. In such terms, literally applicable to intelligent and moral beings, but in figure transferable to the lower creation too, God spake of good intended for living creatures of every kind, that all the latter could apprehend his benevolent purposes. The words cannot intimate, but they do declare that by a beneficence ordination he had made provision for all. The beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven, in common with man, enjoy the benefits of an animal life. With him they are subjected to the operation of causes acting according to the sovereign purposes of God, and with him They are employed by the Lord of all in their varied spheres to fulfill His will. But He, by His great Creator, favored highly above them, is called to obedience in a way to them unknown, yet not less determinate than the laws and dispositions of the material world are His arrangements, especially His covenant provisions made with regard to man. The lower creatures of God, though they know Him not, obey His word. Moral agents on earth are subject wholly to His control. The decrees of His providence affect His intelligent and moral creatures not less than those that know not to resolve. All things continue according to His ordinances, the material creation and His immortal offspring. His statutes bind the heavens and the earth, and by His appointment the relations unto Him into which men are brought, are constituted and sustained. Whatever may be the character of a solemn covenant with Him, to His appointment it is due, and by His will continues. If to them that fear God will be verified the declaration, thou shalt decree a thing, and it shall be established unto thee, Job 22, verse 28, will not all His own holy purposes stand? And was not all that He established, was not the covenant which He established decreed? His purposes and their fulfillment are alike sure. There are many devices in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the counsel of the Lord, that shall stand. Proverbs 19, verse 21. To some who had disregarded His covenant were directed His words, because you have said, we have made a covenant with death and with hell. Are we at agreement? And when the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall not come unto us. For we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the water shall overflow the hidden hiding place. And your covenant with death shall be disannulled, and your agreement with hell shall not stand. But revealing the mediator of His covenant, and consequently making known that covenant as to obtain instead of the covenant with death, which was to be swept away at the same time, He says, Behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. Judgment also will I lay to the line, and righteousness to the plummet. Regarding both the threatening and the promise are His words, This also cometh forth from the Lord of hosts, which is wonderful in counsel and excellent in working. Isaiah 28, 15, 17, 18, 16, 17, and 29. And may there not also be applied to both His own averment? The Lord of hosts hath sworn, saying, Surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand. Isaiah 14, verse 24. The covenant was commanded. When God said, I have made the earth and created man upon it, I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, and all their host have I commanded. He spake of that omnipotent word by which He commanded all their host at least into existence. And accordingly, we are to understand the testimony, He hath commanded His covenant forever. Psalm 111, verse 9. As implying not merely that it should endure forever, but that to His almighty mandate are its origin and continuance due. This the psalmist celebrates when he sings of Zion, There the Lord commanded the blessing, even life forevermore. Psalm 133, verse 3. And this too, in addressing the children of Zion and the God of Zion, he records, Thy God hath commanded thy strength, strengthen, O God, that which thou hast wrought for us. Psalm 68, verse 28. In like manner are the blessings of that covenant thus announced. The Lord shall command the blessing upon thee in thy storehouses, and in all that thou settest thine hand unto, and He shall bless thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And is thus declared that obedience to its requirements was ordained. He hath remembered His covenant forever. The word which He commanded to a thousand generations, which covenant He made with Abraham and His oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law and to Israel for an everlasting covenant. by the Lord of all, obedience to his law is enjoined. But what is requisite that duty be performed is from him, and all needful aid he ordained. His law exhibits what he demands. The allotments of his providence illustrate the necessity of submission to him, and the predeterminations of his will secure the services which he accepts. His laws are perfect. With the arrangements of his providence they harmonize. On the absolute perfection of his nature they are founded. All who obey them declare their approval of his purpose. To encourage such, his purposes are revealed. Because his covenant was commanded, it was made known. Its revelation, with its other provisions, leads to the attainment of its end, and it shall continue. Its benefits will be confessed, and its obligations respected and fulfilled. Contemplating its demands as promulgated by the authority of God, these they will endeavor to satisfy in accordance with his sovereign decrees. The wicked disobey his commandments, but cannot alter the determination of his will. The others make not the purposes of God the rule of duty, but endeavoring to fulfill his revealed will, they are employed with honor to execute his counsel. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spake, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. The counsel of the Lord standeth forever, the thoughts of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom he hath chosen for his own inheritance. Psalm 33, verses 8, 9, 11, and 12. And the covenant of God stands according to a sovereign decree. In virtue of his high authority, the Lord imposed the regulations of his material and intelligent kingdoms, and the laws by which his moral creatures are governed. Hence, terms strictly applicable only to the government of the one are metaphorically applied to the control of the other, and his dispensations to some are employed as symbols of his operations towards the rest. Thus, in language primarily used in reference to the firmness or security of a building, his word, and consequently his covenant, the arrangements of which it embodies, are represented as the creed. Concerning thy testimonies, I have known of old that thou hast founded them forever. Psalm 119, verse 152. As ordained or decreed to the appointments of the material universe, it is compared. Thus saith the Lord, if you can break my covenant of the day, and my covenant of the night, and that there should not be day and night in their season, then may also my covenant be broken with David, my servant, that he should not have a son to reign upon his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. Thus saith the Lord, if my covenant be not with day and night, and if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth, then will I cast away thy seed of Jacob and David, my servant. Jeremiah 33, verses 20, 21, 25, and 26. And especially is that true religion through which covenant engagements are made and kept according to God's decree. Where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? God understandeth the way thereof, and he knoweth the place thereof. When he made a decree for the rain, and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then did he see it and declare it. He prepared it, yea, and searched it out. And unto man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. Job 28, verses 12, 23, 26, 28. Were the rain and the lightning and the thunder decreed? Then no less was decreed the fear of the Lord. To vow unto the Lord was to manifest that fear. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, and serve him, and shall swear by his name. Deuteronomy 6:13. And hence also, not less than every other effect of that true wisdom, which consists in the fear of the Lord, and that of understanding, which is to depart from evil, was ordained the service of vowing and swearing to him. Thirdly, a people were foreordained to make solemn vows unto God. Representations are given of his people as form for his service. According to some of these, the expression to form means to fashion or to bring into existence. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons from far and my daughters from the ends of the earth, even every one that is called by my name, for I have created him for my glory, I have formed him, yea, I have made him. This people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise. Isaiah 43, verses 6, 7, and 21. Remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for thou art my servant. I have formed thee. Thou art my servant. Isaiah 44, verse 21. And hence, because whatever is formed according to God's purpose, his servants to his service and all its parts were foreordained by him. But besides the meaning of the said expression, cannot even in the foregoing passages nor in others be limited to its literal import. It is employed to intimate that God predetermined what his enemies should accomplish. Hast thou not heard long ago how I have done it, and of ancient times that I have formed it? Now have I brought it to pass that thou shouldest be to lay waste the fenced cities into ruinous heaps? Isaiah 37, verse 26. In reference to a covenant people to be continued to discharge their peculiar duties and to provisions of grace described in terms most beauteous, it is applied, Thus saith the Lord, the maker thereof, the Lord that formed it, to establish it, the Lord is his name. See Isaiah 33 and Jeremiah 33, verse 2. And since the purpose of God secure their fulfillment, and so his arrangements concerning his people secure their creation, regeneration, and continued support, does not the expression kindred to others? Thus saith the Lord that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, explicitly advert to them as predestinated to obedience, and especially the obedience thus described. One shall say, I am the Lord's, and another shall call himself by the name of Jacob, and another shall subscribe with his hand unto the Lord, and surname himself by the name of Israel. Isaiah 44, verses 2 and 5. Reasoning on the sovereignty of God exercised in setting apart a limited number to the benefits of salvation, illustrate and assert the truth. Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, Why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had afore prepared unto glory, even us, whom he hath called not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles? Romans 9, verses 20 to 24. In such terms is God described as not merely having created all things, but as having predestinated some to eternal life and decreed that others should be left to perish. The mode of expression embodying the image of the potter agrees with the words of the Old Testament scriptures. Surely your turnings of things upside down shall be esteemed as the potter's clay. For shall the work say of him that made it, He made me not? Or shall the thing framed or formed say of him that framed or formed it, He has no understanding? Isaiah 29, verse 16. What is taught by the use of such language must therefore be implied in those declarations of the prophets where corresponding terms are employed. In the language of the Old Testament, the potter is literally He who forms. According to the Apostle, the potter symbolizes him who predestinates. Hence, since as in the words, Woe unto him that striveth with his maker, let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say unto him that fashioned or formed it, What makest thou, or thy work he hath no hands? Isaiah 45, verse 9. He is compared to the potter. He is to be recognized as the sovereign disposer of the final conditions of all, and for as much as at a given period concerning the existing house of Jacob, framed by him, he says in regard to their descendants, also formed by him, But when he seeth his children, the work of mine hands in the midst of him, they shall sanctify my name, and sanctify the Holy One of Jacob, and shall fear the God of Israel. Isaiah 29, verse 23, depicting all of them in the character of those who avouch him to be their God, the true Israel he acknowledges as formed for, or set apart to, that high distinction of himself, and that the apostle has this in view, his quotations from the prophets were given, declare. It was of the people who should be objects of this promise, and it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, and thou shalt call me no more Bailey. Hosea 2, verse 16. And on whom the privileges thereafter described should be conferred, that was predicted, the blessedness. I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. Romans 9, verses 25 and 26. It is of those to whom covenanting with God refers the promise, the remnant of Israel, and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob, shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. Isaiah 10, verses 20 and 21. That Isaiah also crieth, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. Romans 9, verses 27. And it was of those who, heirs of Abraham's faith, which was counted to him for righteousness, were, as he was, taken into covenant with God, and like whom none remained in the cities of the plain, when these were overthrown, that Isaiah said before, except the Lord of Sabaoth had left us a seed, we had been as Sodom, and had been made like unto Gomorrah. Isaiah 1, verse 9, and Romans 9, verse 29. This ends tape number 12 of the Ordinance of Covenanting by John Cunningham. Please go to the next tape in the series and continue listening. Thank you. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as SWRB's complete mail order catalog containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, CDs, and much more at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalog. If you have a web connection and would like to be added to our email list, please send an email to add@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. This book, The Ordinance of Covenanting by John Cunningham, is also available from Stillwater's Revival Books in softcover format at a discount in our A to Z author listings. And please don't forget to look over the 62 CDs that make up our Reformation and Puritan bookshelf CD sets if you visit our website at swrb.com, as these CDs are a great way to build a major Reform library at a fraction of the cost of the printed books.